Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, and somewhat drenched. Today we have as our guest someone we've been wanting to get for a long time, one of the truly outstanding investigative journalists of our times, who's written some of the most important work of recent years, Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater and many other investigative reports, will be joining us live on the phone from San Francisco. So this should be a great show. I hope you'll enjoy it. But before we go to Jeremy Scahill, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
3,500 people came together in Minneapolis for the 2008 National Conference for Media Reform on June 6th through 8th, as a growing movement to create more accountable, democratic, and diverse media continues to gather momentum. Free Press Executive Director Josh Silver opened the conference.
We dedicate ourselves here today to the proposition that our fight for a democratic, open internet and independent media will end the historic pattern of monopoly that suffocates freedom, dissent, and creativity. Because the future of the media does not belong to Rupert Murdoch. The future of the media does not belong to Comcast and AT&T. The future of our media does not belong to Clear Channel, Verizon, and Tribune Company. The future of the media belongs to us. All of us, and everyone watching across this country, we are here in Minneapolis today and this weekend to fight for all the media that we want. And mark my words, we will not stop this fight until we win.
With more than 250 presenters, the weekend was a chance to learn about the issues shaping our media and to strategize for the future. Former CBS News anchor Dan Rather spoke about the importance of a free and independent press. He said he never imagined that news organizations would cut so deeply to pad the corporate bottom line. But, he said, it didn't have to be this way.
It means that we need to be on the alert for where, when, and how our news media bows to undue government influence. And you need to let news organizations know in no uncertain terms that you won't stand for it. It means that we need to continue to let our government know that when it comes to media consolidation, enough is enough. Too few voices are dominating, homogenizing, and marginalizing the news. We need to demand that the American people get something in exchange for the use of airways that belong, after all, to the people. It means that we need to ensure that the internet, where free speech reigns and where journalism does not have to pass through a corporate filter, remains free. We need to make whole the government to both the idea and the ideal that the red beating heart of freedom and democracy is a free, truly free, and independent, yes, fiercely independent when necessary, press.
Throughout the conference, there was much discussion about the future of media, both in terms of technological advances and social justice. At a panel called Where We'll Take It, Young Leaders on the Future of Media, Jenny Lee of the Allied Media Project spoke.
When I'm looking at the future of social justice organizing and the role that media is going to play within that, I can see two different paths sort of unfolding. In the worst case scenario, I can see the tools of communication we currently have at our disposal becoming more and more advanced to the point that they perfect the illusion of community. Our human relationships that we use for organizing will be replaced by constituent relationship management systems. And online will wage political wars over ideas in the blogosphere with strangers while not ever being able to challenge the people who are closest to us or ourselves in ways that will actually transform relationships. But in the best case scenario, the future of media and the role it will play in our movements for social justice will be its ability to expand our imaginations. Because ultimately, our imaginations are our greatest resource, and the extent to which a corporation or a government can limit or regulate our imaginations is one of the greatest threats that we face. If we can look at our cell phones and instead of seeing an evil piece of overpriced equipment that will never do what I want it to do, even though I'm hopelessly reliant on it, and instead see a GPS navigating device, and then as long as we can see that GPS navigating device and decide to use it as a tool of liberation rather than a tool of surveillance and oppression, then we can create a new window of possibility. And it's through those windows of possibility that we will be able to create whole new worlds.
You can listen to the conference audio at www.freepress.net/conference.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, June 15th, 2008, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today is our guest. We have one of the outstanding investigative journalists in the United States today. Every decade, there are two or three or four books that come along that break open stories that aren't being covered at all by the mainstream media, oftentimes because people in power aren't really eager to talk about them. Our guest today is the author of one of the most extraordinary books in this genre, Jeremy Scahill, who writes for The Nation and is at The Nation Institute, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, award-winning book, is our guest today. Jeremy?
Be with you, Bob.
It's great to have you here. We've been trying to get you for a couple of years, and I'm delighted we're finally able to get you. You are now on a speaking tour, is that correct?
Yeah, what happened is that I really quite radically updated the book with about 140 pages of totally new material, and then went through the book and updated some of the investigations of the Congress into Blackwater, and as well as some of the lawsuits against the company. So I'm going around the country and once again trying to raise awareness on this issue. It just seems like particularly the Democrats in the Congress just can't get their act together on this at all.
Well, you know, for some of our listeners unfamiliar with this story, why don't you just give some of the basics on the use of private contractors in Iraq, the dimensions of it, both the number of people and amount of money, and Blackwater specifically?
Right. I mean, this is really the important stuff for people to understand. That right now in Iraq, there are 150,000 U.S. troops, and they operate alongside a force that's bigger than the U.S. military, and that is this shadow army of private contractors. There are 180,000 private contractors. Now, not all of those are armed individuals like the private soldiers that work for Blackwater. Some of them drive trucks or do laundry or cook food for the troops. And all of these are jobs that historically have been done by the military. And now we see this very radical privatization agenda. Bob, right now in Iraq, there are 630 corporations that are on the U.S. government payroll. They employ those 180,000 people, and they draw their personnel from 100 countries around the world. Many of these people come from governments or from countries whose home governments are actually opposed to the war and have declined to send troops. And so what we see is, in fact, a new model for waging war, where you no longer work with nation-state allies, as George H.W. Bush did during the Gulf War, and you no longer have a draft. And so you turn the entire world into your recruiting center, and you just simply go into economically devastated countries, offer people a bit more money than they can make at home, and next thing you know, you have a rent-an army. And this is really a subversion of sovereignty of nations around the world, poses a tremendous threat to global stability, and also is costing U.S. taxpayers a tremendous amount of money. We spend about $2.3 to $2.8 billion a week on the occupation of Iraq. 40 cents of every dollar spent on the war goes directly to war corporations.
And these are powerful institutions, therefore, as you elaborate on in the book and in your writings, that have a distinct stake in there being a war economy and the United States being at war.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what is the incentive for Blackwater or KBR or Halliburton or Dyncorp or Triple Canopy? I mean, you can rattle off all the names of these companies. They have no incentive to have things get better and every incentive to have things get worse, because we have a system now in this country where corporate profits are intimately linked to an escalation of war and conflict. And so what we're seeing, and Ambassador Joe Wilson has pointed this out, is perhaps the most significant transfer of public monies to the private sector in the history of this country. And what this means is that the Pentagon can't give campaign contributions. The State Department can't give campaign contributions. But by putting this huge amount of money in the hands of for-profit war corporations, you have a special interest group that is, in fact, armed and has an agenda to keep things very, very violent around the world. So it's a very, very disturbing trend and has everything to do with the future of U.S. democracy.
You know, as I listen to you talk and as I've read your work, Jeremy Scahill, I always think of the very famous comment of President Franklin Roosevelt at the dawn of World War II. He said, if nothing else happened in the war, I want to make sure no new millionaire is created through this war, that there's no profit taking this war. And then Harry Truman's political career was built on exposing profiteers during the war, taking advantage of the war economy.
Right, and add to that Eisenhower's farewell address in the early 1960s, where Eisenhower warned quite clearly about allowing these corporations to have tremendous influence over U.S. policy, that with the rise of the military-industrial complex, you had a real risk of unchecked corporate power essentially attempting to supersede the democratically elected government in the United States. And during Eisenhower's time, what we were talking about in the aftermath of World War II was the growth of an industry that serviced the U.S. war machine. And what this industry was at Eisenhower's time were weapons manufacturers, hardware manufacturers. It wasn't, you know, boots on the ground. Now what Bush has done is to dramatically outsource a significant portion of the armed activities in Iraq, effectively creating a paramilitary force that answers not to the U.S. military, but directly to the White House. Blackwater works for the State Department, and so Congressman Dennis Kucinich, when I've talked to him about this issue, he said that he sees them basically as an armed wing of the White House, accountable to no one except the owners of their company and Condoleezza Rice and George Bush.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, which has just come out with a greatly expanded new edition just out. Jeremy Scahill on a national tour talking about an award-winning book. We'll be talking about Blackwater and his other investigative work and political commentary for the full hour today on Media Matters. The phone number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. You know, Jeremy, since the beginning of the Iraq War, the government, the Bush administration, the Pentagon, has been obsessed with sort of minimizing awareness of the human cost
yep.
of this war. I mean, when the caskets of the troops have come back to the United States, they're not allowed to be photographed. They're snuck in the middle of the night oftentimes. They rushed soldiers out of there who were gravely injured. So if they die in the United States, they don't go on the death count for Iraq. They die. They're no longer tabbed. And when I hear you talk about the extent of the mercenary forces and the private contractors in Iraq, you know, that death toll we have for Americans in Iraq alone, which is 4,100 roughly today, the official one, does that include people who are hired mercenaries?
Nope, absolutely not. I mean, this is really what we're seeing here is, I mean, the Bush administration uses these forces for a number of reasons, and we can go into that as we move through the program. But relevant to what you just said, this force actually masks the extent of U.S. involvement. I mean, most Americans don't understand that there are almost 400,000 U.S.-funded occupation forces in Iraq when you take the shadow army and you put it together with the U.S. Army. But when the military guys get killed, you know, there is supposed to be reporting and you have a death count and you have an injury count. When the contractors are killed, it goes nowhere. But I've been able to discover through the U.S. Department of Labor that 1,200 families of contractors killed in Iraq have applied for federal death benefits. So at a minimum, 1,200 contractors have died, and those are just the ones who, A, are eligible for federal death benefits in the United States. Remember, these are people from 100 countries around the world. If a woman in Nepal, if her husband is killed, is she going to come to Washington and file a claim with the U.S. Department of Labor? She probably is totally unaware that she could do that. 13,000 of them have applied for injury benefits under the U.S. Department of Labor's insurance program, which is called the Defense Base Act, which provides insurance for contractors who serve the United States overseas. So at a bare minimum, we have about officially a quarter of the number of U.S. troops that have been killed in Iraq is equal to the number of contractors killed that have applied for these death benefits. I actually think the number is much, much greater, and it could perhaps even be more contractors being killed than U.S. soldiers. We really have no way to discover that, but recent statistics indicate that contractors are actually dying some months at a much higher rate than U.S. soldiers are. And when you don't count them in the death toll, when you don't monitor their activities, you effectively have a shadow army that masks the human cost of the occupation in terms of American and other nationalities' deaths in the war.
Jeremy Scahill, also, I mean, on the subject of deaths, it's the subject that's rarely raised in the United States is the number of Iraqi deaths.
Right.
And this has been a source of controversy in the United States. I don't think much controversy outside the United States, but in the United States, when the scientific studies have come out, which has suggested that the death toll of Iraqis runs between 500,000 and a million since
right.
the start of the war, this has been dismissed pretty much categorically in the U.S. news media as just sort of crazy talk.
Yeah.
From your research and your experience, what's the story about Iraqi deaths?
Well, I mean, first of all, Bob, thank you for all the work you've done in monitoring media coverage over, you know, really over the duration of your career, and congratulations on the Media Reform Conference. I heard so many amazing things about it, and so you're to be commended for that. And I bring it up in this context because, as you have followed over the years, U.S. corporate media coverage of Iraq has been pathetic and has pandered to the powerful and has consistently tried to push away the idea that the U.S. has imposed any form of suffering or collective punishment on Iraq. U.S. policy has been consistent in Iraq since the 1950s, when the Central Intelligence Agency helped the rise of the Ba'ath Party by providing lists of leftists, communists, and others, trade unionists, to be hunted down and killed by the Ba'ath Party. At the height of Saddam's brutality in the 1980s, he was shaking hands with Donald Rumsfeld, and the U.S. was supporting him. He was our SOB, so to speak, and the U.S. funded both Iran and Iraq in that bloody war, which took over a million lives. And then we had the Gulf War, where the U.S. systematically targeted Iraq's civilian infrastructure, and the media coverage of that war was a sanitization process, completely making it seem as though there were these surgical strikes, there were smart bombs. And the reality was that when you take the Gulf War, you combine it with Bill Clinton's economic sanctions and then Bush's invasion and occupation of Iraq, you see one of the greatest mass slaughters of modern history. You don't read about that in the paper. They were constantly questioning the numbers of Iraqis killed under the sanctions as a result of the U.S. blockade on that country and the use of depleted uranium munitions and the rising rates of cancer. I mean, it's sort of been a propaganda campaign for a long time. And so when you talk about how many Iraqis have been killed right now, and you look at the Johns Hopkins study and you look at some of the statistics that have been compiled through medical records in Iraq, and the media, the powerful media barons kind of poo-poo it, the reality is these guys are drinking cappuccino and eating Cinnabons in the green zone. I would defer to Iraqi medical professionals and to the experts at Johns Hopkins before I would trust any of these powerful media outlets, because they've been wrong from the very beginning. They've lied, they've engaged in propaganda, and they've just been wrong about every possible aspect of the Iraq war. Why should we believe them now when they say, Bush says 30,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed? Yeah, Bush also said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Our guest, Jeremy Scahill, joining us today live on the phone from San Francisco, where he's on a book tour in support of the brand new edition of his award-winning book, Blackwater. If you're not familiar with it, it's one of the really great examples of quality investigative journalism book-length form in the last 10 or 20 years, and I can't recommend it highly enough. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Jeremy Scahill, the telephone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. We have a caller waiting patiently. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Jeremy Scahill.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Okay. Yep.
A few comments. I've read portions of your book. I think it's superb, and I recommend it to everyone. And I have a few comments and a number of questions. I can't think of the chap that runs Blackwater, but I've seen him on C-SPAN and so forth, he sure comes across as an all-American Boy Scout, just a perfect little gentleman. I mean, I really distrust the man. And another comment, there is a book that was mentioned on C-SPAN. I can't think of, I believe, a Professor Bobbitt, I could be wrong, Choice and Necessity or something. And he's advocating the privatization of aspects of the military because our soldiers need to be out fighting, and it's cheaper if we have a support system and so on and so on, which I think is ridiculous. And a panel on C-SPAN also had a number of major, semi-major reporters in Iraq, and they were asked, one of the ladies was asked, why don't you do more reporting on Blackwater? And she said something to the effect, we can't get close to them, they're too violent, okay? But here's my question, and it borders on the, I would say almost on the, a little bit on the paranoid side, if I may say so. But there's been a number of little blurbs in the Chicago Tribune about, quote, detention camps that Halliburton had built that hold approximately up to 1 million people. And it is in the Tribune, so I assume it's relatively accurate. But I've heard rumors from friends of mine who listen to Art Bell's terrible program, Coast to Coast, that they're being manned by Blackwater, and that truckers that, you know, drive across the country have drove up to these so-called camps, and they're being staffed by Blackwater. That's my question. I find it a little bit horrific if it's true, and I'll hang up and listen, and thank you.
Well, and thank you very much. And Jeremy, if I can just say, callers, when you call in, if you've got some radio or music on in the background, or you've got a family member playing the accordion, if you could just sort of cool it on that, that'd be great.
I'll put my violin away right now, Bob.
Thanks, Jeremy. I didn't want to rub it in public.
Because I wasn't really listening to you, Bob. I was actually just practicing the violin over here. Well, first to the first part about, I'm not sure whose book the caller was referring to at the beginning, but I mean, this was part of the point of this. The idea of this privatization of the war machine really was born inside the head of heads of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, Cheney, when he was defense secretary under George H.W. Bush during the Gulf War, one of the last things he did was to give a secret contract to Halliburton to write a study on how to privatize as much of the military bureaucracy as possible. Effectively, Cheney created a lucrative market, allowed Halliburton to create a lucrative market for itself, and then went on to head Halliburton during the 1990s, and then Bill Clinton gave Halliburton all these incredible contracts, and we were sort of off to the races with the system. And the official logic of it was that you're going to privatize every single job except the fighting, except the actual soldiering, so that you free up your entire military to do the fighting. And that's really what the U.S. war machine looked like through the duration of the 1990s, beginning with the Gulf War. What changed then with George W. Bush was that these guys then come back into power after spending the 90s working at the American Enterprise Institute and building the neoconservative project for a new American century, and they come in and not only have all of the outsourcing of Halliburton, KBR, Fluor, Bechtel, etc., but then add to it these paramilitary forces. So it's privatization on top of privatization. As to the issue of the camps here, I mean, this has been pretty well documented. Halliburton has been given I believe it's a couple $100 million contract to build these emergency detention centers, and my understanding was that the official reason of it was to deal with an emergency influx of immigrants, undocumented immigrants, which in and of itself, if that's true, is just outrageous that we're gonna have what are effectively sort of concentration camps waiting in the wings. You know, we already have Guantanamo, but that's in Cuba. I mean, if they're building those kinds of facilities inside of the United States, it certainly raises questions. I want to, though, caution people about the issue of Blackwater in this. Blackwater is of course a tremendously bad company, and has it has a scandalous, violent, bloody record. But I also think that some people get off to the races when talking about Blackwater and thinking that Blackwater's head pops up at every evil turn inside of the United States. The reality is that there are a lot of players in this game. Blackwater is sort of a high-end boutique on a strip full of Walmarts in this industry. Blackwater is sort of the elite of the industry. And I think sometimes, you know, people put things on Blackwater that are not really Blackwater, but are in fact another company. And to me, it's a mistake to just think that this is Blackwater, or that at every turn of privatization, or if they're building camps or whatever, that it's going to be Blackwater. The reality is that there are hundreds of companies that are doing what Blackwater is doing. Blackwater just happens to be the most powerful and the closest to power
in this country. The other thing about this sort of, you know, viewing Blackwater as the epicenter of all of this stuff, you know, I was asked the other night, Bob, in New York, if I thought, and I get asked this all the time, so I might as well just throw it out there, if I think Blackwater would ever engage in a coup in the United States. I mean, my response to that is, you know, would that we had a leader in Washington that these guys would think they had to overthrow in a coup. I mean, it's just not going to happen. They're going to win no matter who's in the White House, whether it's Barack Obama or John McCain. These guys have a very secure and bright future. Business has never been better for them. And, you know, in Iraq, they're going to continue on. They'll go to Latin America, Africa, elsewhere. I mean, the future looks very bright for these companies.
Jeremy Scahill, before we go back to the next caller who's been waiting patiently, I do want to follow up on one point that the first caller alluded to, which is, you know, the quality of journalists covering Blackwater and the entirety of the private contractors. You know, after your book came out and after the massacre that Blackwater engaged in, there was a big rush of coverage for a brief period. But it seems to me that it's pretty much fallen off the map again.
Well, I mean, one thing that I've sort of have been pleasantly, I'll flat out say it, shocked by, is that the New York Times over the past month, really over the past 2 months, have run a number of editorials, unsigned editorials, and they've used the term mercenary, they've used the term shadow forces, they basically have called for a complete end to this system, and so the Times, for whatever reason, has sort of woken up to this issue on its editorial page and is really being quite clear about the paper's opposition to the use of these forces. Now, that is by no means intended to absolve the New York Times of its media sins of omission here, because you can find, and I mean, my book is full, I think something like 2,000 footnotes, you can find stories going back, you know, from almost day one of the war, where corporate media outlets are talking about private forces. But as you know, Bob, because of the work that you do, it's not one-off journalism or incident-based reporting that changes anything. It has to be drumbeat coverage. Judith Miller and the other propagandists in the media led the nation to the invasion and occupation of Iraq. They were, as Amy Goodman says, conveyor belts for the lies of the powerful. If we had a media response to this radical privatization of war that was consistent and constantly looked at the bigger picture and recognized this as a very dangerous trend that needed to be reported on, I think we would be in a different reality. And so after Nisr Square last September, all of a sudden Blackwater's on the front pages, sustained coverage. It really seemed like the issue was going to go somewhere. And I think there are two reasons why it effectively fell off and Blackwater's contract was renewed. Number one, the media just flat-out dropped the ball on the issue. Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, became a media celebrity, and he did all these softball interviews on Charlie Rose and 60 Minutes and the Today Show and sort of American Pie, and was talking about how his men are patriots, they bleed red, white, and blue, and what they really are doing is killing the bad guys, and Iraqis only die in traffic accidents and ricochet bullets. And then the other thing that happened is that the spineless congressional Democrats, on the issues that matter most to this country, can never get anything done and never take these things seriously. And there's a combination of factors there. It's political laziness. It's also the fact that the Democrats are now getting more money from the war industry than the Republicans for the first time in 15 years. And so, you know, the crowning achievement of Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid's time in control of the Congress has been to achieve an approval rating lower than President Bush's. And it's an extraordinary achievement for Nancy Pelosi. She should be very proud of herself, because I don't think any historians would have imagined that she could have won an approval rating lower than the most unpopular president in American history.
Our guest, Jeremy Scahill, you've been listening to, author of Blackwater, which is just coming out, greatly expanded paper edition out now. He's traveling around the country in support of the book. If you want to call in with a question or comments, the phone lines are open here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Jeremy Scahill.
Hi, greetings. Yeah, I'm hoping that your book tour is reputedly going to bring you to DeKalb and to the U of I campus and community, and I'm personally hoping that it'll be coincident with a demonstration against SAIC, which is the privatization of intelligence, another category that you probably are following too, but they have a fairly large presence on the South Research Park of the U of I, so well, maybe we can have some activism as well as your great work on Blackwater. You did testify to the Senate Democratic Policy Committee, and I also saw this Donald Vance, and it's an amazing story in and of itself, the way he was keeping information on what the firm that he was associated with was doing. And then he got incarcerated himself and almost treated as an enemy combatant, you know,
right.
Tortured with sound, et cetera. An amazing story. I don't know if you expand on that in a new edition in any way, but what I'm interested about it is the fact that one of the things he was tracking was this firm was handling heavy weapons, howitzers, and I'm wondering whether these off-the-shelf outfits are actually being used in the current war against Iran through Iraq by shipping things to PJAC and other forces,
yeah.
And whether you know anything about that. I know it's quite murky and probably very hard to find anything concrete about that. I mean, the special finding that was signed, according to Andrew Coburn, is just not making any news at all in
right.
the U.S. press. So I would like for you to reflect on that a bit.
Well, there's a couple things you said there that that I do want to respond to. I guess I'll start with the question that you asked, and then I want to go back and say a couple things about DeKalb and SAIC and private intelligence. Blackwater, and I tell this story in my book. In 2005, Rumsfeld sent Blackwater into Azerbaijan, which of course borders Iran, and it was a very quiet deployment. It was a Pentagon contract. Blackwater goes into Azerbaijan, which is right along the Caspian Sea and shares a border with Iran. And Blackwater set up shop in Baku, which is the strategic port city that juts out into the Caspian Sea. And what Blackwater did was to take over an old Soviet Spetsnaz base, a Soviet Special Forces base, and to renovate it and remodel it based on a Homeland Security Command and Control Center in the United States. And then they trained a high-end unit of the Azerbaijani Navy, and they deployed them in the Caspian Sea. And when Iran got wind of this, the Iranian Navy sent its special forces into the Caspian Sea because they considered it essentially an act of aggression to have this U.S. Paramilitary company working with the Azerbaijani Navy in a very, very strategic area, not only for oil, but a very strategic area for a potential conflict with Iraq, with Iran, or an attack against Iran. And so I think people can rightly look at that facility that Blackwater set up and wonder if it could be used as a forward operating base or if, in fact, it is being used for any kind of activities regarding Iran. Rumsfeld, one of his legacies in Central Asia and the countries bordering Iran, was to set up these agreements with these very fragile, repressive regimes where the United States is able to use their territory to engage in military operations. That was crucial for the initial attack against Iraq and would certainly be utilized in any attack against Iran. I was recently with Cy Hirsch in New York, and he seems very, very concerned that there is, in fact, going to be military action, and he wouldn't talk in much detail about it, but he apparently has another story coming out very soon about Iran, and he seemed quite serious in his belief that up until, and he said it, up until like 11:59 a.m. on January 20th, 2009, it's going to be a code red situation, and so I think it's one that you're right to raise questions about. What you said about DeKalb at the beginning, you know, I was in DeKalb and Mount Carroll last year, and met with activists and sort of held a town hall meeting with people who live in the vicinity of Blackwater North, which is, of course, just by the Illinois-Iowa-Wisconsin border. And Blackwater has been up and running on 90 acres of land in Illinois now for well over a year. And on the issue of SAIC and private intelligence, I mean, right now 70% of the combined budgets of all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, 70% of that black budget, we don't know the exact amount, 40 to 60 billion, we believe, is in the hands of private contractors. So there's a radical privatization of the U.S. intelligence apparatus, and Blackwater's owner, Eric Prince, actually started his own private CIA called Total Intelligence Solutions, and they're marketing their services, and they call them CIA-type services. They say this in their promotional literature, to Fortune 1,000 corporations and foreign governments. And that private CIA is being run by three veteran CIA operatives, Kofor Black, 30 years in the CIA, the man who ran the Extraordinary Rendition Program under Bush and the head of the Counterterrorism Center, Robert Richer, the former Deputy Director of Operations at Central Intelligence, and Enrique Rick Prado, a veteran of the CIA Paramilitary Division and an expert on Latin America. Those three are running a private CIA owned by Eric Prince of Blackwater, and they're entering a market that is incredibly profitable and is growing by leaps and bounds every week.
Yes, Jeremy Scahill, you know, you've alluded already to the Democrats and Obama. Let's just talk for a second before we get to our next phone call about the two major presidential candidates, John McCain and Obama. McCain has been running very much opposed to earmarks and corruption and touting his public service as opposed to private sector service in his career. So I'm wondering how he stands on the issues of private contractors and privatization of intelligence in the military. And then Obama has been running on his anti-war position from 2002. Does he have a position on the use of private contractors?
Well, I mean, first, let me just say this. You know, the Republicans could run a head of lettuce for president, and that head of lettuce would be the candidate of the war industry. They talk about how head of lettuce is a patriot and head of lettuce is going to protect us. I mean, so it sort of is irrelevant in terms of who the war industry prefers. They believe that John McCain is going to take the actions that will end up in more profits for them. In fact, I mean, it was just sort of humorous slash frightening to hear Pat Buchanan the other day say that he believes that John McCain could make Dick Cheney look like Gandhi. And then, I mean, coming from Pat Buchanan, it was kind of a...
Was it a compliment from Buchanan?
It was, I don't know. I mean, well, you know, Buchanan is a racist and he's xenophobic, but he also is sort of an isolationist Republican. And you know, I was very critical of the war. And I think, you know, I don't have much respect at all for Pat Buchanan, but on the issue of the war, he's sort of held the fire to the foot of the administration at various times. He kind of goes back and forth depending on which way the wind is blowing. And John McCain, I think the John McCain of 2000... might have taken this up as an issue because of the tremendous amount of money, the political influence of these corporations, and that many soldiers, many military people. I was just with General Mike Myatt, one of the commanders of the Gulf War. He and I did an event together in San Francisco the other day. Many military people, including senior commanders, are very disturbed by this. And yet John McCain, instead of saying anything about it or cracking down on it, actually has a former Blackwater lobbyist and PR specialist as his senior advisor, Charlie Black, who worked under the Burstyn Marsteller umbrella that was controlled by Mark Penn, Hillary Clinton's top strategist. So McCain actually has a Blackwater connection riding around on his so-called Straight Talk Express. And look, I mean, McCain supports Bush's attempt to make permanent the immunity for private private contractors in Iraq, and McCain's Iraq policy would result in almost an exponential growth of these companies in Iraq because the U.S. occupation would be untenable without them. Barack Obama is perhaps second only to Bernie Sanders in the U.S. Senate in terms of really understanding this issue. Obama is the sponsor of the Democrats' legislation on contractors that's held up in the Senate right now. It passed the House overwhelmingly. He introduced that legislation 8 months before Nisr Square. Almost no one was supporting it when he did it. And then after Nisr Square, they sort of said, wow, Obama was way ahead. They're way out in front on this issue. Now, I don't mean this as a compliment to Obama because of what I'm going to say next. I'm very critical of Obama's legislation. In fact, Blackwater's owner, Eric Prince, endorsed the House version of Obama's legislation. And when it passed, he said it was excellent. And the reason is because Obama's legislation looks great on paper. In theory, pardon me, I'm losing my voice here. In theory, Obama's legislation would set up accountability structures and oversight mechanisms and a very clear way to prosecute contractors who commit crimes. The reality is, though, that it'll just exist on paper. It's totally unenforceable and ultimately will be a propaganda victory for the industry because they can say, well, look, we have this Obama legislation that holds us accountable while knowing full well that no one's going to be able to come and monitor the activities of companies who are sent to go where no one else will go. I did a story on Barack Obama's position on this called Obama's Mercenary Position that ran in The Nation magazine, and one of his senior foreign policy advisors who works on this issue told me very clearly Obama cannot and will not rule out using Blackwater and other private security forces, and he won't sign on to Jan Schakowsky and Bernie Sanders' bill, which seeks to ban the use of Blackwater and other contractors. And the reason is not that Obama loves these companies. He's called them unaccountable, above the law, a danger to U.S. troops. It's because Barack Obama does not actually have a plan to end the occupation of Iraq. He has a plan to rebrand it, rename it, and downsize it. But he's going to keep in place the Green Zone, the monstrous U.S. Embassy, control of Baghdad International Airport, as well as keep a strike force in place. Those are some of the major areas of Blackwater's business. And Blackwater right now in Iraq is like the American Express card of any U.S. presence there. You can't have diplomats in Iraq without Blackwater. And so Obama has painted himself into a corner with his position on this issue. And I've been calling on people, you know, look, Bob, most of my best friends are in love with Barack Obama. I'm not trying to break off their engagement. I want them to cheat on Barack Obama with a little bit of conscience on the war. And when it matters right now, between now and November, to really let his campaign know that people want to see his rhetoric, which is anti-war, backed up by an actual anti-war plan. And right now, that's not the case. He's misleading his supporters when he says he's going to end the war in 2009. It's just flat out not true.
Our guest, Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, a fellow at the Nation Institute, a longtime contributor to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have him with us today. If you'd like to call in, the phone number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's get back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air.
Yes, I also hope you can come to the University of Illinois, maybe after DeKalb. Because we have a history here of a relationship at the University of Illinois with Blackwater and the resignation of Tom Dempsey,
right?
The director, and also, you know, Blackwater Midwest is only a few hundred miles away. But can you talk more about Blackwater's role in local law enforcement in the training of public law enforcement?
Yeah.
SWAT teams, and specifically about the Backup Training Corporation and you know, their CDs that I think 9,000 police departments use, and, you know, how Blackwater, since they have purchased that company, may use that, you know, for training of local law enforcement.
Right. First of all, there are some great activists that are working on this issue in the DeKalb area, Dan Kenny and some others who've really been on the Blackwater beat in Illinois for quite some time. And of course, the scandal that you raised about the University of Illinois was a very important story. It was very important that was exposed. I was just in San Diego a couple of days ago, where Blackwater just opened up its Blackwater West location. And this was about a 2-year battle. Blackwater got defeated in their attempt to open a facility right along the U.S.-Mexico border in a tiny town called Potrero. And then when they lost that battle and had to pull out, they registered under a shell company or a ghost company a facility in San Diego itself, in the city, 3 blocks from the Tijuana International Airport in Mexico. And an activist found out about it, and they raised a ruckus, and then the city of San Diego actually stood up to Blackwater, and then Blackwater, its lawyers 2 weeks ago, went to a federal judge appointed by the president's father and asked her to intervene, and she intervened and ordered the city of San Diego to allow Blackwater to open shop in San Diego. And so I was there at a pretty big demonstration the other day when Blackwater had just opened, and they say that they're just doing training. But when Blackwater first started in the late 1990s, the name of the company was Blackwater Lodge and Training Center, and they said, well, all we're going to do is training. Now they're this very powerful private force that's being deployed all over the world. And to me, even the line, oh, we're just training people, that shouldn't be reassuring to anyone. What does their training look like? I mean, this is a company with expertise in paramilitary training, and we are seeing a paramilitarization of law enforcement in this country. And so any community whose law enforcement agents are being trained by Blackwater certainly has a right to look at what kind of training are they receiving. When Blackwater says counterterrorism, what does that mean? And we have a real radical paramilitarization of law enforcement in this country that's happening. And Blackwater trains 25,000 to 30,000 law enforcement agents a year. It's very important to dig into the curriculum there and see exactly what kind of training they're providing to local police forces.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest today in Media Matters is Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, which has just been updated. He's on a speaking tour supporting it. I'm Bob McChesney, and this is WILL AM 580. Let's now go to line 4, San Francisco. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Jeremy Scahill.
I'm sorry I missed seeing you the other day, Mr. Scahill. I have really been fascinated by your reports. I felt like I just had to call in when you were talking about the low ratings for Nancy Pelosi, because it seems like I feel this very strongly living here in San Francisco, that almost everybody has these feelings about some of these candidates and so forth, but it seems like it's never mentioned what the alternative is. And I had to bring up the fact that she's got Cindy Sheehan,
yeah,
America's number one peace activist, running against her for Congress this year. And it's shocking to me that even here in San Francisco, where we try to drum up support for people, so very few people even know who she is.
Right.
And there's a reason for that. The Chronicle and the major newspapers have a virtual, not complete, but almost a virtual blackout and disinformation about her. You know, the articles are unbelievably, they make fun of her or whatever, or they skew stories about her. People have these strange conceptions that she's an egotist, and she's, you know, she's doing it for the money, and all sort of weird things that's encouraged by the press. But I just am calling to say that whenever people talk about all these horrible things that are happening in our country, and it's something new with every passing day, they never mention the real alternatives that are out there, people who are struggling, fighting for things like against the war. It's so easy to talk about Obama being one of the better of the bunch in Washington, but there are actually people running who are against the war, who want our troops home, who want to impeach Bush and Cheney, and want to look into a real investigation of 9/11.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Jeremy?
Yeah, I mean, I was just with Cindy Sheehan the other night, and invited her up to say a few words at an event that I did in San Francisco, and have done work with her over the years. And she is, in fact, challenging Nancy Pelosi, and I concur with what the caller is saying about the way that her campaign has been covered in the media. I mean, regardless of what anyone thinks about Cindy Sheehan, this is a woman whose son was killed in this war, a war that was ultimately authorized and paid for by the Democrats. And the fact that she is running against the Speaker of the House is very significant. And this is not just some, you know, sideshow circus. I mean, Cindy Sheehan takes this very, very seriously, and she's running because she ultimately feels that the Democrats, the Democratic leadership, are as responsible as the Bush administration for the continuation and the continued funding of this war. Now, you know, on the broader issue of alternatives, I mean, I was just reading a really interesting essay by Ted Glick, who's one of Cynthia McKinney's major supporters of the Green Party. And Cynthia McKinney is campaigning for president. She's trying to get the Green Party nomination. It looks like she will. You know, this is an African-American woman with very progressive politics who's running as the Green Party candidate. I think that you know, for many people, the important issue is to build a multi-party system in this country and to support independent candidates who actually do have a true across-the-board progressive agenda. The problem, though, right now, you've got Ralph Nader running, and Nader, you know, Nader, of course, has a very, very progressive platform and has been, you know, a real hero for years and years. Cynthia McKinney, very progressive. She certainly has some baggage attached to her, as Nader does, but, you know, this is a very progressive, prominent African-American woman who has been the victim of witch hunts for the duration of her political career because of her outspokenness on U.S. foreign policy and race issues and others. Many, many people from the anti-war camp have been co-opted into the Obama movement. Now, we can start sort of trying to self-destruct and attack people and say, oh, well, Obama's just a shill for the interests of corporate America, or we can sort of step aside from the bigger issue of who are you going to vote for and realize that there's a momentum and an energy that I think is very positive for those of us who believe in justice. And the key here is to try to convince people this isn't about one man or one election. This is about changing the face of the country. And the reality is that Barack Obama has policy positions that are not well publicized, that are at odds with a great many of his supporters. And so it's very important for us to hold him accountable to his rhetoric, because his rhetoric is not backed up by his plans.
Jeremy Scahill, during the Democratic primary debates between, primarily towards the end, of course, between Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton, it was routinely talked about when the Iraq came up that while Iraq has been a fiasco and now is conceded to have been the wrong war to get involved in, Afghanistan, on the other hand, is a good war, and it's the kind of war we should have. And also, it's almost uniformly held by Democrats that the Kosovo War and the Yugoslav Wars of the 1990s were other good wars. And I know you've covered these wars. How do you respond when you hear this?
Well, I mean, I think that Noam Chomsky really coined the phrase, the new military humanism, where you have these sort of U.S. imperial interventions that are cloaked in the rhetoric of we need to save these poor people, and that's never been the agenda of U.S. foreign policy. It's not about saving these poor people. It's about advancing U.S. interests and, when possible, spinning it in a humanitarian, humanitarian jacket, and that's what we've seen the Bush administration actually do that with Iraq. When the WMD thing fell apart, they started saying, "Well, we had to liberate the Iraqi people and remove the threat of Saddam Hussein." The issue of Yugoslavia, I mean, I speak Serbo-Croatian. I covered that war on the ground. I mean, the United States systematically dismantled one of the most progressive countries in Europe. And one which ultimately was standing up to U.S. neoliberal politics, and they did it under the auspices or the guise of going in to liberate the Kosovo Albanians. The United States has supported an ethnic cleansing regime in Kosovo where non-Albanians have just been systematically expelled, and it's a crisis that now has far exceeded the original crisis in Kosovo that justified, quote-unquote, the U.S. intervention there. And we see the same flames being fanned over Darfur right now. The reality is that Sudan is a very oil-rich country. China has the market cornered. The United States doesn't want that. And so we're seeing, an escalation of rhetoric against Sudan. The same thing is happening in Somalia and the Horn of Africa. We're going to be living with these so-called humanitarian interventions for the rest of our life. And I think that it's very important to recognize that U.S. policy is always dictated by expansion of the empire and defense of corporate profits.
Our guest, Jeremy Scahill. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go to another caller now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello. Three practices which our country's war machine promotes hatred for our country and ensures that we will not run out of enemies to keep the corporate profits alive in the war machine. Number one, the killing of innocent civilians. Number two, the detention for 6 years and counting of people who have not been charged or confirmed as alien combatants. Some of these people, I think, were picked up just on a bounty for turning in people who were so supposedly al-Qaeda. And number three, the plowing under of peasants' crops with no alternative. And forget the fact that that's opium. If indigent farmer's only means of support is agriculture, and his crop gets plowed under and he doesn't get an alternative, he's going to turn to the other side. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy.
That seemed to be more of a comment than anything else, so we can move on.
I think that's more of a true-false question. Jeremy, some people asked me when I said you were going to be on the show to talk a little bit about your background. How did you get into journalism? How did you get to the point where you were researching Blackwater?
I got into journalism quite by accident. I was working at a homeless shelter in D.C. and I was mopping floors and just kind of cleaning up, and I started listening to talk radio in a Walkman, and it was right around the time when Democracy Now! Started, and I had never heard of Pacifica Radio, and I heard this Amy Goodman and just got addicted to this show, and then I began a relentless campaign to pursue doing anything I possibly could for Democracy Now!, and I after 3 months of calling Amy Goodman, she finally agreed to let me come in and volunteer. And the first day I went in there, this was in late 1997, She had me clipping newspaper articles, and she was in literally a closet at the WBAA offices in New York with no window, and that was her office. It was her and one other person, and so I started at Democracy Now clipping newspapers, and then Amy started paying me $20 or $30 a day to write the news headlines, and she was paying me out of her own pocket, and I learned journalism. I never studied journalism, never took a journalism course in my life. I don't even have a college degree. I learned journalism as a trade, the way you would being a plumber or an electrician. I just happened to study under someone who I think is the finest journalist in America, Amy Goodman. But I very much learned it as a trade, with a sort of apprenticeship working with Amy. And she and I have been friends and colleagues for more than 10 years and worked together very closely. But I studied in the Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez School of Journalism, and was very, very fortunate to be a part of Democracy Now! Pretty much from the beginning, and continue to work with Democracy Now! To this day.
And you, this past year, were on the Bill Maher show.
I'm a correspondent for him, covering the elections. I didn't do the first part of the season because I didn't want to cross the picket line. I didn't want to violate the strike. But I've been reporting for him, and will continue to do that in August when it goes back on the air.
We have time for one last caller. Let's go to line one, Champagne. And could I ask you to be brief, if you could?
Sure. Good morning. I agree with about 90% of what you say, but with respect to Kosovo and Bosnia, I don't understand the logic of Chomsky either when he makes these comments, because what geopolitical interest do we have in, like, in extending the American empire into Kosovo? And I think it really was humanitarian. I mean, what they were doing with the paramilitary and things like that was a tragedy, like, in the offing, which had been repeated just a year or two before. So I don't know. What's your logic of that?
First of all, I mean, the situation on the ground in Kosovo, the United States was talking about 1 million ethnic Albanians missing and 10,000 dead. The United Nations report indicated that there were a couple of thousand, 2,000 people that were killed with no determination of their ethnicity. The United States propaganda campaign, spearheaded by Madeleine Albright, was trying to make Kosovo look like a genocide, when a few countries away in Turkey, you had the U.S. selling weapons to the Turkish government to just slaughter the Kurds, one of the greatest ethnic cleansing campaigns in recent times, and the United States was fully supporting it. Yugoslavia has great geostrategic importance to the United States. The U.S. built a huge military base, Camp Bonsteel, in Kosovo, that's been used for supporting the attack against Iraq and would be used in any potential attack against Iran. It's also a major thoroughfare now for human trafficking, for narcotics smuggling, and the fact was that they smashed a state that had an alternative economic model, Yugoslavia, and crushed it into 1 million little pieces with all of these para-states now. And the United States ultimately had a divide-and-conquer agenda in Central Europe. I mean, the sort of good victim, bad victim policy of the United States was abundantly clear in Yugoslavia. The United States has supported ethnic cleansing in Yugoslavia in multiple countries, and certainly in Kosovo. The U.S.-backed regime in Kosovo is arguably a narco-smuggling terrorist regime in the heart of Europe. And go and talk to other Europeans about it. People are not happy in greater Europe about what the United States has done in Kosovo. It's a highly destabilizing factor in that region now.
I have to ask you before we go, where did you learn Serbo-Croatian?
In Yugoslavia.
You taught yourself?
Yeah, I learned it in the streets. Yep. And I know now I speak it and read it. And I was even reporting for B92. It used to be an independent station. Now it's totally co-opted. But I would report from Baghdad for them in Serbian as well. And I write for the equivalent of Time magazine there from time to time, a magazine called Nin.
Well, Jeremy Scahill, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they're going to push me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today.
Bob, thanks for all the work that you do. You're a real media hero in this country, and one of the great fighters for justice, not just in media, but for a just country. And I thank you really deeply for the work you're doing.
Well, those words mean a great deal to me. And listeners, I want to let you know that Andrew Boyle has been our producer today, doing a great job. Jason Cross has been working the board. We'll be back 1 week from today with another show, and I hope you all have a great week. Thank you very much. Take care.
This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for the entire WILL severe weather coverage area until 7 o'clock this evening. A flood warning is in effect for eastern Clark County for urban areas and small streams until 9:15 Tuesday morning. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, meteorologist Dan Pounder says partly cloudy with a chance of thunderstorms, the high 87 degrees with wind from the southwest at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Tonight, isolated thunderstorms with some potentially being severe, the low 62 degrees with wind